Hi, Curtis. My name is Ari Eisen, and I'm a professor here at Emory in biology and interdisciplinary studies. And this is an interview that my friend Gary asked me to do for his magazine, Sacred Matters. So I went and read your book, which I enjoyed, and I just thought we could do an informal few questions about the book and see how it goes. I think one way that the science delusion draws a nice line, I found, is that quotation you had from a physicist where he says, some people believe that consciousness arises from molecules and will be able to figure it out. And other people think that molecules kind of arose from consciousness, like we created them or we found them or something.
Well, it's sort of like the question of, is there such a thing as a molecule by itself?
Exactly.
Is there such a thing as an atom by itself? Because you just keep going down into tinier and tinier parts. So, in some ways, that's a very Buddhist idea. It's called dependent origination, that there's no thing in itself because you can always break the thing down into other component parts. Like they used, like hold up a piece of paper and sort of say, is this a piece of paper? Or is it the water, the tree, the labor, the sunlight, and everything else that went into making it possible?
Exactly. And would you say that that's a kind of fair characterization of the division that you're addressing in the book at some level?
I mean, at the basic level, the division that I'm trying to make, and it's one that I've had an awful hard time communicating to people, is the distinction between the activities of science and what is claimed about the activities of science. In other words, at the extreme edge of those claims about the activities of science is something that I call scientism. And I mean very specifically by that term, science as ideology. In other words, science, the voice of science in one way or another, participating in the construction of a social reality.
So given that, I kind of tested out your idea, and I went to one of my colleagues in the biology department here, and I said, because he thinks a lot about consciousness from a biological perspective, and I said, so do you think that once we understand enough of the molecules that we'll understand consciousness? And he said, oh yeah, very confidently. So
But you see, the problem there is that what are we talking about when we're talking about consciousness? I mean, the word consciousness is basically just a place marker. So it's a verbal place marker for something that we think we experience, that we think is real, but we don't actually know entirely what we're talking about. So immediately, he has to, I think, the thing to do is to sort of say, well, what do you mean by consciousness? I mean, a lot of people think that animals have consciousness, and in a certain sense, they do have a rudimentary consciousness, which is to say they have an awareness of their environment and they have a capacity to act upon it. But animals, I don't believe, have an ego awareness or a sense of self that is sort of a self-reflexivity. And to me, that's the sine qua non of human consciousness, is that self-reflexiveness.
And that science will never be able to explain that.
Well, that's why, he should be asking you, well, what do you mean by consciousness?
Yeah, we actually talked about that.
Yeah,
And we talked about awareness.
right. Well, that's the kind of qualification that I think is extremely important to make. I mean, I'm fascinated by any aspect of scientific investigation. What I'm troubled by are the kind of claims for it that follow. So if a scientist says, I have no doubt that we'll be able to understand at an atomic level what consciousness is, I mean, because after all, molecules are just made up of atoms, I want to push that so that I'm sure that claim is not overextending. And this is a big problem with neuroscience right
Sure. Yeah, so much of it is, as you point out, metaphor. It's not reality. They're using metaphors, and they kind of get caught up in their own metaphors.
But the cover story of the current Scientific American, which I subscribe to, is all about the century of the brain,
right?
The forthcoming century of the brain, and I've got it right here in front of me. The title of the thing is that the new century of the brain: revolutionary tools will reveal how thought and emotions arise.
Right.
And I said, the devil.
Right.
First, it's the same thing as with consciousness. You've got to say, well, what's a thought? You know, too often scientists just assume that that everybody knows what these words mean, and it's a settled matter. But, you know, what is a thought?
Another thing that along these lines that I began to realize when I was reading your book was I've written a lot about this and other scientists, and you see it even in introductory science textbooks, is this concept of an emergent property.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that something can be more than the sum of its parts. And I started thinking that, are we just, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Something is more, if it's an emergent property, let's say that consciousness is an emergent property of neurons. Is that just science saying we don't really know what's going on? And is this getting to something that you were talking about? You know, are emergent properties, we could say this is another example of emergent properties, but is that really just something we're waving our hands at because we don't understand it? So I don't know if you had any thoughts about that.
Well, you know, in a certain sense, I think it would be healthy, or it is healthy, when scientists sort of acknowledge that we don't really know what we're talking about, and we have this term for that we use when we don't know exactly.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess my point was, we think we do know what we're talking about. Oh, that's an emergent property. We got it figured out.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So the term emergent property gets reified. It gets turned into a thing.
I think it might have.
So yeah. When what it really is doing is sort of acknowledging a gap, you know, perhaps even a place where the scientific method can't itself go.
Exactly. That's what.
Which is something I think that scientists in general are reluctant to acknowledge, that there's a place where the scientific method can't go.
Right.
But, you know, if my argument is always that an acknowledgement of the symbolic construction of the human world, in other words, language, symbolic orders, and culture, are an enormous part of what it is that science is studying without necessarily being aware of it.
Yeah.
So, for example, in neuroscience, In looking at the, you know, the structure of the brain and the way that neurons work, Jacob Bronowski said that the greatest contributor to human evolution is culture.
Mm-hmm.
That it is that one of the reasons that the brain has developed and humans have developed in the way that they have is because it's constantly having to respond to or survive within these completely artificial contexts, which we call cultures, right? And so the organic properties of the brain that neuroscientists look at are actually themselves something that are, the organic properties of the brain are responding to culture,
right,
are responding to symbolic orders. Not to mention that at the individual, so that's at the big level, right?
Mm-hmm.
The brain as such. At the smaller level, where we're talking about an individual's brain, well, obviously, that individual's brain and what goes on, the way his brain is wired, as we like to say, and even the way that it is structurally, is deeply informed by the particular culture that that person
right.
was born into. So the brain as such is always steeped, like tea. It's steeped within a particular cultural formation, which has got to be part of the problem for neuroscience.
Yeah.
Never see it.
And, of course, invariably affects the way the scientist is operating, right? That
right.
individual scientist is operating.
The assumption, you know, is that it's just brain activity.
Right.
That watching and mapping and tracing brain activity is going to reveal
solve the problem.
How the brain works. While, you know, but the brain activity is completely cordoned off from, separated from all of this other symbolic stuff.
Right. Yeah, that's an important point. Also, I think
the really important part of that, I think, for the conversation that we're trying to have right now at a sort of an intellectual level, is the fact that the sciences need other ways of talking in order to come to terms with this.
Yeah, another thing along those lines I was thinking about is when you mentioned that scientists don't like to admit there's things that we don't know or that we won't be able to know.
Right.
I like the way you bring in, I guess your kind of contrast to science is the romantics, but it doesn't have to necessarily be that contradiction. How science deals with contradictions or things that don't quite fit. And you bring up not just the romantics, but other philosophers, et cetera, that have a whole different way of handling contradictions.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you might talk about that a little bit in this context of how scientists think about the work they're doing. And how non-scientists think about what scientists are doing.
Well, I would think that contradiction is, you know, I mean, is something that scientists and science in general has to deal with all the time. If for no other reason than the problem, the paradox of confirmation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So recently there's been quite a bit of news about this study that claimed that it could not, scientists involved claimed they could not replicate 47 out of the 53 major cancer studies that sort of fundamental, you know, posts in the field of cancer studies. And that's an enormous problem for them because, well, it's not that those 53 things are useless, but the problem is, what are they? Are they just, you know, the science wants to be able to claim that they're truths or they're facts about the field, but there's no confirmation of that if it can't be replicated, and they can't replicate them, but they continue to be useful.
Right.
So there's this enormous sort of paradox or problem.
Or they continue to be used.
It can continue to be used, but then that makes science something that is basically pragmatic.
Right.
And from a scientific point of view, that's not really what most scientists are after. They're after, you know, something that sort of goes beyond, well, this works, we don't know why.
Right, right.
Let's keep doing it, you know. So they want to go beyond that. But so that's one way in which contradiction, I think, is a daily part and should be a problematic part of scientific thinking. You know, simply the openness to the fact that confirmation is a problem. If for no other reason than because of things like confirmation bias.
Right.
But the biggest picture of contradiction is where the scientific method and scientific empirical logic, say empirical reason, is sort of contradicted by other forms of reason.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for a scientist, basically the claim would be that there is no form of reason that is superior to or that really should count for much other than empirically based reason.
Right.
But for me, there are many other kinds of reason. I don't know if you read the Tricycle interview.
Oh yes, I did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in which I begin to sort of talk about that, the fact that the idea that the only reason worthy of the name is empirical reason is actually a piece of ideology.
Sure.
It's a story that's told to the culture, and the degree to which the culture believes that story and acts upon in accordance with that story will have important kinds of social consequences.
Certainly, certainly.
So my claim is that, well, actually, no, there are other kinds of reason. And the form of reason that I'm most interested in the book, especially in relationship to romanticism, is I think what most philosophers would call dialectical reason.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I deal with in talking about Friedrich Schiller and romanticism is sort of the origins of dialectical reason, because dialectical reason, as we know it, is a fairly recent phenomenon, like in the last 250 years, that has really developed in that way, basically out of Rousseau. But a lot of people in talking about my use of romanticism simply say, oh, he's just a romantic guy. You know, we know what romanticism is. But I take an awful lot of trouble in the book.
Yeah, I agree.
To talk about, okay, how am I using this term? And for me, romanticism in general is a very, very misused term and a misunderstood concept.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really unfortunate name.
You convinced me that two things. I think, I don't know if you agree, I think you're using that as an example first of all, a powerful example of other ways to view the world. It doesn't have to be the only one, but also, you come right out and say you're an atheist, but on the other hand, you kind of give some credit. You say these spaces that I'm talking about could be, some might use the divine in those spaces. So I didn't get that, but I did want to ask you. I've been lucky enough to be involved in a project that, because I think what you're calling for, although you do it kind of in a provocative way, is for different ways of viewing the world to come together, not to exclude each other in any way, right? And I've been involved in this project working with the Dalai Lama and the monks and nuns in exile. What's very interesting about this project, other than the fact that we're teaching science to monks and nuns, is that the Dalai Lama came to us.
Right.
So the non-scientist, if you will, came to the scientist and said, teach us about this stuff. We think we have something to bring to the conversation. We think you have something to bring to the conversation. So it wasn't this kind of colonial capitalist, whatever approach of science, which often happens, but it was in the other direction. And I've just been involved in this project. It's really got me thinking a lot about, I think that's why a lot of what you wrote resonated. I'm just wondering about your thoughts about projects like this and about what are best ways of...
I've known about the Emory Project for quite a long time. In fact, I have been financially supporting a monk in Dharamsala in India for 15, 20 years.
Oh, is that right?
He started out as a child, and now he's a grown man, and I'm still sending, you know, it's a very minor amount of money, but, you know, so I've known about that program for a long time. And I think, you know, going back into the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of interest in the way in which especially physics and Eastern religion could be joined. So the Tao of physics and the dancing Wu Li master. And, you know, it became quite popular for a while. It seems to have receded a bit. The question, and if you read that, like people that some of the you know, post-Einstein physicists like John Wheeler, they're always saying things that sound halfway Buddhistic.
Yes, yes.
So, but the thing that I always wonder about the Emory program is the degree to which, I mean, I understand that the monks are studying science, but
the other direction.
To what degree are Emory's science students encouraged to study, say, the Dharma?
Right.
That's philosophy, which is fascinating, right?
Yeah. Yes. That's a part we're developing, right? Because it came from the other direction this time. But we certainly have Emory students going physically to Dharamsala and now to southern India, and the Emory faculty doing the teaching. But that's a part of the conversation that definitely needs to be enriched. But we're aware of that, and we're working on it. And to me, a lot of different things changed just by going through that experience about the way that I teach science and the way that I think about science. Just having that extreme version, if you will, of difference, but yeah, that's something that I think we're very much aware of that needs to be enriched and continued, and we are working at it. And some
Is there a lot of resistance there among some of the faculty and students to the idea that, you know,
at Emory or in Dharamsala?
At Emory,
resistance more so originally with the higher levels of the monastic orders. That's where most of the resistance came from, abbots and things. I think there was this this connection in their minds between scientism, communism, China, scientism, and a lot of that's gone away after some of their monks have actually participated. Here, not so much resistance. I think students seem to be really open to, first of all, a lot of our students are interested in science and how, quote, Eastern ways of science can help in healing and helping address the things they're already interested in. But a lot of humanities students have been involved in meditation programs and going to Dharamsala. Our president and the administrators have been very open to it. So the only minor pushback I've heard here and there is from the Chinese community, certainly the official Chinese community in Atlanta and a little bit at Emory, but probably the most one of the most striking results of the project has been conversation between Chinese students and the monks here at Emory, a kind of underground community of discussion, of real discussion going on.
Well, that's great. But, you know, I another thing to say about, you know, studying the Dharma is that it is, as I point out in the tricycle interview, is that it's not particularly otherworldly. It is, in fact, the thing that I try to point out is that, like the romantic dialectic, which is, you know, the dialectic is simply a philosophy that involves a process of change, right? And I describe that in the book. But also, the Dharma, the Four Noble Truths in particular, describe something very similar, a kind of dialectical process, if you will, that attempts to move people from a condition of suffering to a condition of not suffering. And it does that by addressing certain kinds of delusions, which is something that science has certainly done over the years, like over the centuries now, you know, much to its credit. So it the Dharma, the Four Noble Truths, especially address the delusion that there is something to this thing, the ego or the self. Mm-hmm. Instead, they say that an excessive belief in the idea that you are an ego is actually the beginning, the source of suffering. That's mm-hmm. why you suffer, is because you keep trying to confirm yourself. You try to realize yourself by making yourself grand, self-aggrandizement, you know, mm-hmm. and then that self-aggrandizement then becomes the source of suffering. So it's a process of reason, but it's a process of dialectical reason, and it doesn't start with an empirical fact, but I think it does start with a kind of realism, mm-hmm. which is to say that, you know, to be human in the world is to suffer.
So this might be an entry point for you as well in the conversation, because if we're looking for places where science can productively enter the conversation.
Right. Well, I think that the thing that has to change is that science has to recognize the validity of other forms of reason, which means forms of theological reason and forms of philosophic reason and even forms of aesthetic reason.
Yeah. One of the ironies as you're speaking that struck me in this project with the monks is how much more open they are to the science than the scientists often are to what they're doing.
You see, that's a problem. That's a cultural problem.
Yes, yes.
That people who are attracted to science and who grow up into the scientific community have certain kinds of stories repeated to them over and over again from their first high school science class about what science is. And once they buy into those narratives, it's very difficult for them to open up again. So they see all other forms of reason as a menace, you know, that ultimately it's all, as the new atheists have complained endlessly, that criticism like mine is simply a way of giving the creationists a certain kind of credibility.
Oh, yeah.
Me?
Yeah, I hear that too.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, Curtis, I appreciate your time. I'm wondering if you might close with some reflections on something you do write about in your book. The implications for what you're talking about for liberal arts education and where you see this, what we've been talking about, fitting into that conversation.
The humanities are in trouble, and it's not only because, although it is partially because of the new sort of curricular emphasis on science, technology, engineering, and math, but it's also a problem of not knowing. I don't believe that the humanities know who they are anymore. Mm. So right now, the response to STEM-type thought, an emphasis on scientific education, is in the humanities, is to become more scientific themselves. So you have things like the new thing in the humanities appears to be the digital humanities, which I think is an utter waste of utter waste of time. So my hope is that. Humanists and the humanities will become more humanistic, that is to say, more knowing about their own intellectual traditions and the value of those traditions to the present, that those traditions are still working. Because one of the most important things that I say about Romanticism, I think, is that it never died. in fact, in some ways, you know,
right.
Morris Peckham says, a romantic scholar says that romanticism was actually human history's second chapter. The first chapter was about finding yourself within human communities, within civilization. The second chapter is about distancing yourself from those communities and sort of saying, I'm not comfortable within my own community. I don't like it, my own community. So that's something we're still very familiar with. It's called alienation.
Yes.
And it was certainly a driving force in the counterculture of the 60s, but it's still around.
Oh, yeah.
Much still around. So, you know, responding to that feeling of alienation through art and finding art as a way out of that. Mm-hmm. Something that we see in the indie music community all the time now and in other indie art scenes. And obviously we saw it all over the place in the 60s. But, you know, what I would, you know, to me, the humanities will become more relevant when it sees that its own tradition is still at work, not in the academy, but in the world around them.
Right. Very good.
So,
yeah.
So, you know, that's why I'm not so comfortable myself with the idea that I'm a scholar, because I don't want to talk to scholars.
Right.
I could talk to scholars, and I hope that I do, but I don't want to talk only to scholars. I want to talk to people, because I think that the problem that the humanities addresses, that art addresses, is in the world or it's nowhere.
Thanks, Curtis. That's very insightful and I think positive. It can be interpreted as a positive way to end our interview. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time.
Right. Bye.
Take care.
You too.